Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. The UN Security Council votes unanimously to pass a resolution pushed by the United States depriving North Korea of $1 billion in revenue, UN Ambassador to the Nikki Haley.
The price the North Korean leadership will pay for its continued nuclear and missile development will be the loss of one-third of its exports and hard currency. This is the most stringent set of sanctions on any country in a generation.
The move for additional sanctions is response to Pyongyang's intercontinental ballistic missile launches on July 3rd and 28th, which showed North Korea may now have the capacity to reach the U.S. mainland and much of Europe with these missiles. China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, held a bilateral meeting with his North Korean counterpart on the sidelines of the ASEAN meetings in Manila. Wang said that he urged Pyongyang to adhere to UN resolutions. Russia said Sunday that the U.S. is soon sending its envoy for negotiations over unrest in eastern Ukraine to Moscow for talks about the ongoing violence there. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov made the announcement after an hour-plus meeting in Manila with U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. It was the first high-level contact between the two countries since U.S. President Donald Trump last week reluctantly signed new sanctions into law to punish Moscow for interfering in the 2016 presidential election, supposedly to help President Trump win. Lavrov said that the U.S. diplomat Kurt Volker would meet with Russia's envoy for the Ukraine crisis. Volker last month visited eastern Ukraine, where Russian-backed separatists have been fighting Kiev's forces for more than 3 years. This is VOA News. The Latin America trade bloc suspended Venezuela's membership just hours after the newly elected Constituent Assembly ousted the country's chief prosecutor. The suspension is indefinite. Venezuela joined the bloc in 2012 and has been suspended before for failing to uphold its commitments. Venezuelan Socialist Party leader Diosdado Cabello said Sunday that a terrorist attack had taken place at a military base in the central city of Valencia. He is a supporter of President Nicolas Maduro, and he said on Twitter the troops acted quickly to control the irregular situation at the military base. The announcement came after a video was posted online early Sunday, showing men in military uniforms, some of them carrying rifles, declaring a rebellion against Maduro and the state where Valencia is located. Despite months of violent protest against the measure, Venezuela's controversial Constituent Assembly was inaugurated Friday. The assembly is expected to rewrite the constitution to give new powers to the ruling Socialist Party. Israel plans to ban Al Jazeera News Network from the Jewish state. Communications Minister Ayub Kara said that he wants to revoke press credentials from Al Jazeera reporters, which would prevent them from working in the country. Pakistan has dismissed latest U.S. assertions it is selectively fighting terrorist groups or allowing insurgents to use Pakistani soil for plotting attacks against Afghanistan. U.S. National Security Advisor McMaster told American news station Saturday that the Trump administration wants regional countries, particularly Pakistan, to stop providing safe haven and supporting bases to the Taliban. A foreign ministry spokesman said Pakistan has taken action against all the terrorist elements without discrimination. He said, "We have never allowed, nor will anybody ever be allowed, to use Pakistan's soil against any other country." Japan on Sunday marked the 72nd anniversary of the U.S. nuclear bombings of Hiroshima that led to the end of World War II. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe spoke at a ceremony.
"To truly realize a world without nuclear weapons, the participation of both nuclear states and non-nuclear states is necessary."
The Hiroshima bombing killed around 140,000 people, either instantly or from radiation burns in the immediate aftermath. Another bomb was dropped on the port city of Nagasaki 3 days later, killing an estimated 70,000 people. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
UPND welcomes the decision by the former president of Nigeria to visit Hakainde Hichilema in prison and to help to resolve the political crisis in Zambia.
The former Nigerian president Olusegun Obasanjo visits Zambian main opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema in prison.
I thank people who voted for me. And I was very encouraged by those who trusted me with their vote. It has given me much courage to talk more for a democratic Rwanda.
The leader of the Rwandan opposition party, Frank Habineza, concedes defeat.
I think it's time for us to reach out to Eritrea and take them up on some of their offers of doing things that would be good for us and good for the order of the world, in the sense that they would be opposing radical Islamic terrorists.
And a congressman wants to mend U.S. relations with Eritrea. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South African President Jacob Zuma and former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo met Zambian President Edgar Lungu in the capital Lusaka Saturday. The meeting forms part of an effort to resolve the political crisis. President Lungu permitted the former Nigerian leader to visit main opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema, who is in a maximum security prison. Hichilema, who refuses to accept the victory of President Lungu in the last poll, awaits trial for treason charges after his convoy refused to give way to President Lungu's motorcade earlier this year. For reaction about Obasanjo's efforts to resolve the political crisis, I reach Charles Kakoma, spokesman for the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND.
The UPND welcomes the decision by the former president of Nigeria to visit Hakainde Hichilema in prison and to help to resolve the political crisis in Zambia. We think that there is need for pressure from the international community to help resolve the political crisis in Zambia.
Former President Olusegun Obasanjo is believed to have tried to convince Hakainde Hichilema, your leader, to end his dispute or the challenge of the outcome of the election as part of the effort that he is making to end the political crisis. Will he consider that?
We have no details of what they discussed. And President Obasanjo himself did not issue any statement tell us what they discussed with Hakainde Hichilema. But there are just speculations on what could have transpired. We've seen some social media statements, some conflicting, that President Obasanjo tried to ask Hakainde to withdraw the petition. And we have just received another statement. We don't know whether it's true or not from Obasanjo, but he never said that. So there's still confusion as to what was discussed. And as of now, we do not have any official statement.
But he addressed the media. Subsequently, South African President Jacob Zuma was also in the country where the two of them met President Edgar Lungu to try to find ways of ending the political crisis. Do you have confidence about some of these efforts being put in place by these world leaders to try to resolve the crisis in Zambia?
We have every confidence that the involvement of these world leaders will help to resolve the conflict in Zambia. In fact, there has been a growing criticism that the world leaders, especially the leaders in Africa, have not done enough to help resolve the conflict in Zambia. And in particular, criticism has been going to South Africa and President Jacob Zuma that as a regional power, they should have taken the lead in addressing and helping to resolve the issues in Zambia, but they took a backseat. Now that they are coming on board, it is welcome.
But some people also are blaming the UPND for what they call intransigence and trying to undermine the mandate given to President Lungu following the election that he won.
Well, we don't see how UPND is doing that. What UPND has done, as provided by the Constitution, is to take a legal route to try to resolve the conflict by going to court to challenge the election of President Edgar Lungu. And that is what is provided in the Constitution. There's nothing illegal about that. But in response, the government does not want the petition to be heard. That is where the problem is.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for the main Zambian opposition, United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from Lusaka. The Rwandan National Electoral Commission has declared longtime President Paul Kagame the winner of Friday's presidential vote. With 98.63% of the total vote cast, the victory gives Kagame a third 7-year term. The president, who has been in power for the last 17 years, was challenged by independent candidate Philip Mpayimana and Frank Habineza, leader of the opposition Democratic Green Party. Both challengers combined received less than 2% of the votes. I reached opposition leader Habineza in the Rwandan capital Kigali via telephone link-up to get a reaction regarding the outcome of the poll.
I thanked people who voted for me, and I was very encouraged by those who trusted me with their vote. It has given me much courage to struggle more for a democratic Rwanda. I've also thanked party members and my family who stood with me and the campaign team throughout this. And of course, Electoral Commission and other government organisms which made sure that we had a peaceful election. We highlighted that, of course, we had a rough beginning as a party, and even the campaign had a bad beginning, but we never gave up. We continued and were able to cover the whole country. The 19 days, so that was a big experience we have learned. We received the preliminary results yesterday, and we are not pleased with the outcome. But as a Democrat, we congratulated the winner, President Kagame, for the victory, and wish him all the best.
In your initial submission, you said you are encouraged by people who voted for you. How can you be encouraged when you got less than 3% of the total vote cast, with President Paul Kagame getting over 98% of the vote?
Because people, when I was campaigning, people showed a lot of support to me, a lot of love to me. They loved our manifesto, and they believed, like me, that Rwanda would be a country which could be better, which could have some changes, democratic changes and improvements. And I know that I have a very strong support base. And I don't know if people turned up to vote or not, but I still think that we are still there. They still look at me. And I also don't betray them. I will continue fighting for them.
Frank, some people are saying that why would you contest an election when you know very well you stand no chance of winning, and that you were brought in by the ruling party to legitimize the entire process, and that, you know, people should not pay heed to you at all.
That's not correct, because we are a political party. We were established our political party in 2009 to have political power, and have political power through democratic means. So we don't believe in armed means or coup d'etat. We believe in participating elections to have political power. So this is our first election, for our first shot, our first try to enter into the president's office. So we had to do our best, make sure that we make a mark, and to make sure that we win this election, and we did our best. And also, we have learned a lot from this election. We've got a lot of experience, which we'll use to win other elections in the future.
Well, there are suggestions that it was only 1 week given to presidential candidate yourself, President Paul Kagame. Are there any changes that you would suggest to the Electoral Commission to make, you know, to allow access, more time to campaign in the run-up to the next election?
Yes, we want the Electoral Commission to increase the period from 19 days to at least 45 days. We have started districts in Rwanda, who said that every district could have its own day, and at least 15 days for the diaspora. So this would make a campaign more able and more feasible. But 19 days in certain districts was too harsh program for us. We had to do two districts a day, and it was so difficult to cover the whole country.
So how are Rwandans reacting to the outcome of the elections based on what you have observed when you held a press conference? How was the reaction following the election?
Most of those who supported me, they are very unhappy. They expected victory, of course. We had expected the victory at least 65%. So my people are not happy. But you know, an election is an election. There has to be a winner and there has to be a loser. So even though we are not happy with the results, but we congratulate the winner.
Do you see the election as free, fair, credible, and transparent?
The election was peaceful. The campaign was had problems, as I mentioned. We had the obstruction from the local authorities, but the election was resolved. And yesterday we had some challenges, as I mentioned, with the observers who were not allowed to full access. But in general, the election was okay.
Frank Habineza is the leader of the Rwandan opposition Democratic Green Party. He spoke with me from Kigali. Meanwhile, supporters of President Kagame and his ruling party are celebrating the election victory as a true reflection of the situation in the country. They rejected accusations that supporters of the opposition were intimidated and harassed in the run-up to Friday's election. For analysis of the current situation in Rwanda, I reached Lieutenant General Ambassador Kayumba Nyamwasa, a former chief of defense staff of the Rwandan Defense Forces in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Well, it's a shame, even for President Kagame to be believing that he got 98%. He should be ashamed of that. Those are figures you can never get in a democratic elections. Those are figures that you register in a dictatorship. So essentially, he has confirmed himself as a dictator. The very fact that he can score those numbers, that's very shameful, particularly when he knows very well that the real opposition leaders are in prison, dead, or in exile. Exactly, he's standing alone. Kagame has been competing against himself, so we wouldn't have expected him to get less than 98%. In any case, I wonder why he never gave himself 100%.
Well, General, RPF supporters are saying that even if the internal polling results could not be believed, what about the external one? Rwandans in the diaspora, he got similar results of at least 98%. This, they said, showed that the man is very popular and Rwandans overwhelmingly want him to be the leader of the country.
Tell me, who are the observers in those embassies? If you have got an ambassador and you've got a first secretary and a first counselor, they are the polling agents, they are the observers, and they just give out those numbers. So how would you be able to establish that? In any case, people who are outside and go to vote at the embassies are indeed only RPF members. I never voted. Here in South Africa, we have got probably 6,000 people, Rwandans, who are living in South Africa. Tell me, what are the people who voted? Maybe 200? So that's not a reflection of anything. If you are voting from embassies and people from one party go to vote, the only people from that party go to vote, of course you get 100%. And in any case, the elections out of the country were never monitored. Nobody was monitoring that. And the opposition parties are not represented outside. If you ask Habineza, if you ask anybody, or even the opposition leaders who are in prison or in exile, they never went to vote.
What is causing that? Because RPF supporters are saying that Frank Habineza of the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda competed fairly. So is Philip Mpayimana, who also competed fairly. They were giving some time to campaign and they made their case, but they were resoundly rejected by Rwandans.
Well, essentially, Rwanda is a one-party state. Habineza and Mpayimana were supposed to give credence and legitimacy to a rigged election. And they know very well that those are the figures they will get. You cannot expect, for example, that Mpayimana or Habineza are more popular than Twagiramungu, who was in Rwanda and who would have given Kagame a run for his money in 2003. They give him, 3%. So that's not a new phenomenon in Rwanda. In 2010, Victor Ingabire wanted to stand. And because she could not compromise, she was thrown into prison. So essentially, those people you look at, Habineza and Payimana, those are surrogates of Kagame. And definitely, that's why they got those figures.
Well, I understand former President Juvenal Habyarimana used to get similar 98%. Why is Rwanda have leaders who usually get 98%?
Absolutely, because you see, Kagame and Habyarimana are the same, except that, you know, maybe Habyarimana was less brutal than Kagame. So the numbers are the same, precisely. And this shows you why did the RPF go to war. Among other things, they were choosing Habyarimana of rigging elections up to 98%. And that's what Kagame is getting. So obviously, it is a lost cause. It is a lost struggle. And therefore, Rwanda struggled for nothing. They struggled against one dictator, and they have installed another.
Lieutenant General Ambassador Kayumba Nyamwasa is a former Chief of Defense Staff of the Rwandan Defense Forces. He spoke with me from Johannesburg in South Africa. A congressman wants to mend U.S. relations with a country under U.N. sanctions in the Horn of Africa, Eritrea. An amendment submitted by U.S. Rep. Dana Rarabaka of California pushed for a military relationship between the two countries to fight terrorism. VOA Salem Solomon has the story.
A Republican congressman says he believes it is time for the U.S. to reach out to Eritrea and forge a partnership to fight terrorism. U.S. Representative Dana Rohrabacher of California submitted an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act that would encourage the U.S. Secretary of Defense to negotiate with his Eritrean counterpart to cooperate on the war on terror, security in the Red Sea region, confronting Iranian proxies in Yemen, and other U.S. security priorities. The amendment was rejected, but Rohrabacher said he may try to push for cooperation with either a future amendment or standalone bill.
I think it's time for us to reach out to Eritrea and take them up on some of their offers of doing things that would be good for us and good for the order of the world in the sense that they would be opposing radical Islamic terrorists.
Human rights abuses and authoritarian rule have long made Eritrea an international pariah. Eritrea and many members of its ruling regime are subject to UN sanctions imposed for an unresolved border dispute with Djibouti and the country's alleged support for Islamist militants in Somalia. But Rohrabacher believes U.S. policy needs to change. He says it is colored by Eritrea's larger, more powerful neighbor and longtime enemy, Ethiopia.
We should not be just hanging our hat on the side of someone like the Ethiopians and just letting them direct what our policy is. And Eritrea is in a very strategic location, and it is working with people that I think are very responsible people in terms of the war against terrorists.
Eritrea hosts a military base operated by the United Arab Emirates at the port of Aseb, from which the UAE conducts missions in its war against Houthi rebels in Yemen. A UN commission of inquiry found that Eritrea has a wholesale disregard for the liberty of its citizens. The commission concluded that the country imprisons dissidents without trial and forces its citizens to serve indefinite national service. Thousands of Eritreans have risked their lives at sea to flee the country. But Rohrabacher believes the U.S. will have very few African allies if it allows concerns about human rights to dictate its partnership on the continent.
Very few of them have a human rights record and a record of honest government that would be acceptable to the United States. So we should be basically figuring out what is in the interests of our country, and does that government even know meet the minimum standards of being in a relationship with us?
Khalid Beshir, a board member of the Awati Foundation, a group that works to counter what it calls Eritrean propaganda, recently told the U.S. House of Representatives that a U.S.-Eritrea partnership is unlikely, and the Eritrean government continues to blame the U.S. for many of its woes.
Do you think the U.S. is behind pretty much everything, including people leaving the country, sanctions, the border demarcation? The rhetoric basically squarely puts the responsibility on the U.S. I think the Eritrean government has not learned to take responsibility.
Bashir believes allying itself with Eritrea would put the U.S. at odds with much of the rest of the world, who are demanding the country improve its behavior.
It's very simple. This is contrary to the U.S. interest, what he's proposing, because it will go against the international community that has put sanctions on Eritrea for the last 7 years. The role Eritrea has been playing as a spoiler, as a destabilizer. destabilizing force in the region, I don't know how that will serve the U.S. interest, even from the security point of view.
Salem Solomon for VOA News, Washington, D.C.
The Kenyan Elections Observation Group, or ELOG, plans to deploy about 5,000 observers to monitor Tuesday's vote. ELOG also will use parallel vote tabulation, or PVT, to monitor the presidential election. For VOA, Lenny Ruvaga reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
The Elections Observation Group, ELOG, which is made up of civil society and faith-based organizations, met Saturday in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, and said it will deploy about 5,700 election observers. Of those, approximately 1,700 observers also will monitor the elections using parallel vote tabulation, or PVT. Simon Wanjiru, the PVT manager at ELOG, says the group is non-partisan, so its election observers will give independent and authentic results. ELOG began monitoring elections in Kenya in 2010. Wanjiru adds that the system will be used as a monitoring mechanism to flag irregularities.
We want to increase the confidence in the public process on the elections, and also we want to remove any uncertainties on the people. They need to believe that now the systems have been done right, and we will be able to show if they have been done correctly by the commission.
ELOG officials say PVT works in five steps. In the first stage, observers go to polling stations and verify whether they have network coverage. Once this is verified, the second step entails the observer filling out a simulation form and sending it to the data center. This ensures the observer understands the process of reporting via text message or SMS. The third step involves the message check, where the database receives the text and checks for any errors in answering. The fourth step involves the data reporters contacting observers who have not yet reported and troubleshoots. The fifth and final step includes a data quality check, where errors and inconsistencies are flagged by the database automatically. Wanjiru says the monitoring group will abide by constitutional mechanisms in a scenario where results are withheld.
It's only the IEBC that is mandated to release the results. But for ELOG, we only do the verification. So we can't verify before they have released. Remember, the constitution says that IEBC has to release in 7 days. In case it goes beyond 7 days, we don't just say we are going to release, but we will compel. We have a court. And we can use the other also CSOs who can now help, and now we can beef up and compel the IBC to have the results out, and then we can verify.
Joyce Majiwa of the Institute for Education in Democracy, IED, spoke to VOA on the sidelines of the press conference. According to Majiwa, the IED seeks to nurture democracy and good governance in Kenya and Africa. She further notes that the key areas in Tuesday's polls include electoral rules violations, among others. Majiwa adds that the monitoring will improve systems for future elections.
We'll make recommendations for future preparedness. We can make recommendations for if there are violent areas, especially women and girls, we can make recommendations for prosecution. We will have to follow up whether prosecutions are happening. We'll make recommendations to political parties as well.
In 2013, ELOG monitored elections in Kenya and projected President Uhuru Kenyatta's victory at 49.7%, while the official figures from IEBC stood at 50.07%. Kenya is scheduled to vote August 8th. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth review and discussion on the electoral process and results of the presidential elections in Rwanda and Kenya. Election fever in East Africa. On the next, Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin at the World Athletics Championships in London. American Gatlin, who has twice served a doping ban, pulled off a shock win to end Usain Bolt's reign in the Jamaican's final individual race. The 30-year-old Bolt had been favored to secure his 20th global gold in the final major championship of his glittering career, but the three-time 100-meters Olympic champion had settled for bronze, finishing behind Gatlin and his USA teammate Christian Coleman. The controversial American Justin Gatlin secured a surprise victory in a season's best of 9.92 seconds. Fellow American Christian Coleman at 9.94 took silver, with eight-time Olympic champion Bolt still the reigning 100 meters and 200 meters world record holder in bronze, clocking 9.95 seconds. Bolt is expected to compete in the 4x100 meters relay on August 12th, and should he and his teammates retain their title, his tally of world championships golds will rise to 12, two more than long-distance runner Mo Farah, who is second on the all-time list. Talking of Mo Farah, on the opening day, he had his 10th consecutive global track distance title, and at 34, he was hailed as his best ever. He leaves 10,000 meters running with a class performance, made in part by the bravery of Uganda's Joshua Kiptegei, who chased the defending champion all the way to the line. Farah sprinted past the finish line in 26:49.51, the second fastest time in World Championships history of the 10,000 meters. Uganda's 2014 World Under-20 champion, Joshua Kiptegei, took silver, and the Kenyan Olympic silver medalist Paul Tanui was third. Farah will run in heats of the 5,000 meters on Wednesday as he attempts to double up at a major championships yet again. Meanwhile, Kenya's Geoffrey Kirui won the men's world marathon on Sunday, making up for his country's podium no-show in the last two championships. Kirui, this season's Boston Marathon winner, clocked 2 hours, 8 minutes and 27 seconds for gold, 1 minute 22 seconds ahead of Ethiopian rival Timurat Tola. Alphonse Simba of Tanzania claimed bronze just 2 seconds adrift of Tola after 42 kilometers around the 10-kilometer Thames River embankment loop in central London in glorious sunshine. Now moving on to football, Ivory Coast has ruled out co-hosting the 2021 Africa Cup of Nations. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara pointed out that his country has just hosted a successful Francophone Games. He says his country will not need to co-host the expanded Africa Cup of Nations finals in 2021. He said the country has the capability to host 24 teams rather than 16 as stipulated in its original bid. Ivory Coast were originally given the rights to host a 16-team event, but in July, the Confederation of African Football decided to increase the number of teams from 16 to 24. The tournament has also been moved from its traditional dates of January and February to later in the year in the months of June and July. Finally, former heavyweight world champion Vladimir Klitschko has retired from boxing, ruling out a rematch with Britain's Anthony Joshua. The Ukrainian was knocked out in the 11th round by current champion Joshua at Wembley Stadium in April. The 41-year-old two-time former world champion, who held the in-fight title from 2006 to 2015 before losing to Joshua's fellow Briton Tyson Fury, end his career with a record of 64 wins and 5 defeats. Joshua must now face mandatory challenger Kubrat Pulev before December 2nd or risk being stripped of his IBF belt. Bulgarian Pulev, who is 36, has a record of 25 wins and 1 defeat, which came to Klitschko in 2014. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Le padre frappe encore.
Na komyo mona pasi, pona nini yoko talate, mawaya moninga oyo asali.
Claude Lukeba Kweno.
Paya angana gana mayele, kasi soki poli mweko trouble, yangai.
Excellence Bonaventure Ngobo.
Afrique sa monene, jamais koko kanana bolingo oyo pesa kangai. Yangona pesa ki o monte manana jere.
General Davira.
Soki o bebi singana, bebi obongi sinabongi. Eza la vantaja ngai na yo, Adolphe Tre Muteba.
Claude Maluma.
Mote manana, epa na yo. Nasala li susu nini, makani si esele na nabongo.
Jean-Dominique Okemba, Zambé
Antsenke,
Jean-Sébastien Massiano, Junior Bilumbo.
Par défaut, ma belle Chantal et Tumba.
Yves Mosengo.
Le doari, Podomo, Nazo Flede, Podomo, Ponaboyiba, Fukaba Samele, la Malika, Moya et Na incompétence, Yabasouzi, Yabalabala, Na soulevé, juridiction et compétente.
Général Ndenge.
Afrique sa mon nene, jamais koko kana na polingo oyo pesa kanai. Yango na pesa ki yo motema na majere. Soki o bebi singa na bebi o bongi
Chef Gislain Lozolo.
Eza la vantaja na ina yo.
Monsieur Laurent Bourson ne bon kasa.
Motema souri ya mona neza ki loko la mona bebe babo.
Birlenge, Jean-David Kiambote, Sisi Malamba.
Oh ya ya el chilambuina.
Colonel Daniel et Coforce de Frappe. Colonel Elvis. La ville est tranquille. Général Delphin
Kaïm.
Rigen Mata. Cornélie Malungi. Shana Peko. Emerald Lompala. Boss Okito Pandashana. Eric Gaël Miboto. Pamela Sexy, PDG Moutamba Biwan, vieux Bernard Tola, Didas Pembe.
Je m'inscris en faux. Nabakisation, yon se baso porté contre Naï, sur base à ma songe. Et Zali, un fondé.
Clarisse Okitona Paris.
Pas calomnie, pas désordre. Siliana Coco Kati.
David Sala.
Nassina Messana Namilelo. Nasina misana na basho.
Bal sileri.
Ausimo kana kolelisa.
Nabukavu Ramazan.
Sana nanyo sa elingi mutimana yo.
Olivier Mukoko.
Hey, biju vangu. Tala si masonga moto.
Viena nga lui onema.
Ada muteba. Tala si masonga moto.
Foto shiko.
Ada muteba. Tala si masonga moto.
Perimika.
Moto passie, Nathalie Simana Zongi Moto.
Eric la tortille, Papika que la foudre, Docteur Midi, Alain Chakupewa.
Babi et Konzoe, Jean-Louis Makabou Nitazini, licencié Jules Ziombele, Yamama Marceline, inspecteur Didi Kelo Kelo.
Nasina Mistana Namilelo, Nasina Mistana Nabacha,
Colonel Donald Yoke,
Awasimo Kalakole Lisa, Nai, Salana Nanyo So, Elingi Mote Maneo. Alex Fumuti, Talasi Mazonga Moto, Didier Ngando, Talasi Mazonga Moto, Eda Musamba, Ricardo Ngandanga.
Nanisikia, hello, na maneno natamani kukwambia, hello, tafadhali usije nikatia, hello, ona mpaka nasahau kusalimia, habari gani, leo nimekumbuka sana, na mama yani, tukuwazaga, vipi nyumbani, hali ya mumeo na wani, na anti shani, wachimwaga. Kidonga changu charo, mado kinanitia tabu. Najitahidi kukaza roho, ila nadhidisha adhabu. Tena silali bo, nasubiri maajabu. Maumivu yangu, yajapata dawa.
Ya moyo,
And that was our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As we observe the conduct of elections in many African countries this year and wonder why there is so much titanic struggle by politicians to capture the jewel in the crown, the all-powerful executive presidency, the time is opportune for scholars, politicians, media people, and specialists to ask the question whether the all-powerful executive presidency is conducive to the building of robust democracy in Africa. In many parts of Africa, there are hardly any sufficient check and balances to an all-powerful executive president. Yes, we have seen from time to time, like in Nigeria, that the judiciary could be independent and can check the executive. Similarly, we have seen in South Africa an independent judiciary checking the power and influence of the executive. But these are not the norms. The norms are all-powerful executive. Africans have come to accept the practice. We are for some of the mundane things, it must be taken to State House to be resolved by the all-powerful executive president. Even foreign emissaries, when they visit African countries, will not feel themselves satisfied until they have an audience with the all-powerful executive president. Recently, we have a situation in Zambia when the leader of the opposition was detained because it was alleged he did not respect the motorcade of the president and thereby put his life in jeopardy. Why is it then that while others don't accept it, we accept it in Africa? Recently in Turkey, when President Erdogan tried to put forward a referendum for an all-powerful executive, he was challenged. Even though he won, political instability remains in Turkey. The all-powerful Great Britain did experience what Africa is experiencing today. There was a time when the crown was so powerful in Great Britain, and this led one parliamentarian, John Dunning, in 1780, to have the courage to put a resolution in Parliament which states the power of the crown is increased and ought to be diminished. Surprisingly, that motion passed in Parliament, and it began the stage where today, by constitutional means, the crown is only symbolic and has little or no political power. That model was copied by the United States and has influenced many other countries. In the United States, you have co-equal branches of government, the presidency, Congress, and the judiciary. And that has served the country very well, and those who have coupled that model. You have today a president who may believe he is all-powerful, but he has been checked by the judiciary, and recently Congress is also insisting that it is a co-equal branch of the government. Even when President Trump walked away from the non-binding Paris Climate Agreement, the governor of California made it very clear that California would accept all the terms of that agreement, and he was followed by other governors and mayors. So this is what Africans have to ponder. Now, some say the reason why Africans accept it because of the chieftaincy idea which has been in African culture. This may be true, but we also have the case that the colonial period did not help matters. Under the colonial system, there was only one authority. In fact, prior to the 1960s decade of independence, a British scholar wrote, and I quote, "In the Crown Colony, the governor in the Crown Colony is by law, both in law and in fact, the sole authority." So this is the model which Africans have accepted, and maybe also the French. And this needs to be reviewed in these changing circumstances. And hopefully, with what we now know, scholars and politicians will come together to re-examine whether this is the appropriate model for the African continent. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sale, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, without effort, no harvest will be abundant. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As ISIS is defeated and the territory it once occupied is liberated, it is becoming abundantly clear that the effort to defeat this terrorist group will take much more than just removing its malign presence. Iraqi forces prevailed because of their courage and determination to retake their country from these terrorists, enabled by coalition training and support, writes Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, Brett McGurk. The military successes, he continues, were paralleled with an unprecedented humanitarian response. In Mosul alone, around 930,000 civilians fled the fighting, and every one of them has received humanitarian help. Our focus with the Iraqi government and United Nations on immediate stabilization programs has allowed more than 225,000 to return to their homes and 350,000 children to return to school. Nationwide, over 2 million Iraqi civilians are back in their homes in areas liberated from ISIS, writes Mr. McGurk. Today, while much of the efforts in Iraq to defeat ISIS has turned toward stabilization, the main battle has moved to Syria, where U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces and the Syrian Arab Coalition are making a hard push to liberate Raqqa. Already, over 40% of the city has been cleared of ISIS terrorists. The accelerated military campaign to liberate Raqqa means we must redouble our efforts to identify, coordinate, and fund stabilization projects, writes Special Envoy McGurk. The United Nations needs $140 million in additional humanitarian assistance for its Raqqa response, and we estimate over $50 million will be required for explosive hazard removal, he writes. The UN also estimates that a further $560 million will be needed for humanitarian needs in Iraq nationwide. Last month, the United States responded with a further $119 million for humanitarian assistance and $150 million for stabilization programs for Iraq, and $20 million for the Syria Recovery Trust Fund. I again congratulate the government of Iraq, Iraqi security forces, Kurdish Peshmerga, and the entire global coalition on the liberation of Mosul. Together, we have come a very long way, but there is more to do, writes Mr. McGurk. We call on all our partners to consider where their assistance will have the greatest impact and donate generously.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.